Okay, we want to continue on with the commandments, and the next one is the sixth. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Obviously, this is the commandment that commands the virtues of chastity, modesty, purity, self-denial, that is the virtue of mortification, self-restraint, that is temperance, in relationship to the pleasures of touch, St. Thomas says. And this includes everything from passionate kissing on. So if you're not married, people always ask, what can you can't do? Well, passionate kissing and anything more than passionate kissing and more is morally sinful. That's what Pope Alexander VII, I believe, is the one who said. He condemned the proposition that passionate kissing was only venially sinful. So these are the things that are required. Chastity, of course, is the virtue which restrains the lower appetites so that they just simply don't move until reason says they are supposed to. Modesty, again, is the deals with our externals. Then there's the virtue of purity. Purity is of three kinds, according to the saints. The first is that you never violate anything against the sixth commandment, that is in action. The second is that you never violate the ninth commandment, which is in relationship to thought. And then the last is, and that's actually connected more to the first commandment, is that the saints talk about there's a kind of purity in which a person never allows anything into their mind unless it's under the aspect of God, God's purity itself. So there's a certain purity that's attained by only thinking of Him all the time. That usually takes a certain degree to, or a certain amount of effort to achieve, obviously. This also forbids, of course, chastity and modesty and self-restraint, obviously in relationship to those who are unmarried. St. Thomas Aquinas makes the observation, based upon, you know, St. Paul says that the husband is the head of his wife. But St. Thomas observes that the natural law actually dictates that the father is the head of the daughter until she's married. Most people don't have a clue about the significance of the weddings, the symbol of the wedding ceremony for the entrial procession. It's the father's place to bring in the daughter, because as her head, he brings her in, leads her by the hand, to the altar. He takes her hand and places it in the hand of the groom as a sign of his consent to her, his daughter marrying him, and as a passing of headship. But before he does that, he lifts the veil as an indication that you can now contract bodily rights with my daughter, and then he hands her hand to him. So most people don't realize. So what does this mean? St. Thomas says that the sin of fornication is actually a greater sin against justice to the father than it is against temperance. Even though it's immediately against temperance, but it's also a sin against justice. Because the father's rights to protect the integrity of his daughter are being violated. Also, there's justice to husbands and wives by not committing adultery and divorce, so that's, again, has to do with justice. And I think that this is one of the reasons why, as soon as people start violating the sixth commandment, you'll notice in a culture that injustices just kind of break out all over the place, right? And it's because of that actual connection. I also think that this is one of the reasons why I'm concerned, you know, in the past, and this was actually even part of the American culture, that understanding was part of the American culture up until about the 20s or 30s, and then it started collapsing, and the Second World War completely did it in. But it was the understanding, because when women would go to college, a woman couldn't just run off to college and just do whatever she wanted. She had to go and be under in a dorm where there was a headmistress. And that was the headmistress's job, who was acting in as the proxy to the father to say, like, I'm going to keep you straightened out here, right? So I think that there is, and it's not to denigrate women, it's ultimately to protect her honor. Honor is praise for excellence. It's to protect her excellence so that when she goes down the aisle, she actually has an excellence that she is taking to the altar with her. And I think that's something that's just completely foreign to our culture, of course. The seventh commandment, thou shalt not steal. Obviously, this commands commutative justice in relationship to others and their rightful claim over their property. So it's a matter of, look, I got to render this guy his due. I mean, this is his property. It's not my place to steal it. But it also means I can't trash it. It also commands retributive justice in relationship to if I've damaged something or if I've taken something, I have to pay back. But it also means it requires to pay back in relationship to things I've borrowed or lost, or that I've lost. So if I go and I borrow some guy's drill, and this is something that's always bothered me about our current generation. My father always told me, look, never borrow anything unless you have the money to buy it. And the reason being is because if the thing got destroyed under your use, you had to go replace it to give it back. Because all the moral security, if you borrow it, the guy isn't giving you ownership. He's allowing you to use it, which means the moralists say that there can be reasonable wear and tear based on how much he concedes that you can use the thing, but you have to return it back in the same condition in which you got it. Otherwise, you sin against justice. So, and today, people will just, you know, they'll borrow something, completely trash it, you know, and then they'll just say, oh, sorry, man. Well, sorry ain't good enough, right? So you, because there's a matter of justice. It also, we have to make reasonable attempt to restore others' property if there's something that... also, counselor command others to do injury to another person or to his goods, or careless or malicious injury to the property of others. You know, these are the things that retributive justice. So this command is said, look, you have to render justice to people. It commands truthfulness, the virtue of truthfulness in financial or business affairs. You're not permitted to commit fraud. You know, I always used to think, when I was younger, I thought, you know, at least there's not too much fraud in our country compared to some of us. But then as I got older, I started doing a lot of reading about our economic structure and the political structure and how they're intertwined, etc. And when I found out about fractional reserve lending, that literally you go to the bank only has to put in 1/10 of the amount that they owe, and they can literally write another zero on the end of your account. That's how they lend you the money. They literally create 90% of the money that they lend you out of thin air. There's a name for that. It's called fraud. So our entire economic system is based on fraud. It's a mess. And that's actually one of the reasons why it's got to get straightened out. So then what... Yeah, so it's a mess. If you want to watch an excellent video, it took Documentary of the Year in its class like 2 or 3 years in a row. It's just called The Money Masters. You can watch it right off of YouTube. When you read that, it will be the first time you will actually probably say to yourself, I actually understand my country. You might think you understand it now. Wait until you watch that thing. Because the thing I like about it's no conspiracy theory. It's total nonsense. The guy is a PhD in economics, and he just brings you through the last 450 years of history and shows why we are in a situation that is incorrectable within the current system. It's excellent. Okay, it also, so you have to be truthful in relationship, no concealing of fraud. It also commands legal justice, that is, to those who are above us. Tax evasion by not paying just taxes is immoral. We all have an obligation to pay a just amount. People come to me in confessions, usually in March. You know, hey, Father, what's the... You know, can I hide some of this money? And I said, okay, here's the story. Christ said, render to Caesar what Caesar. You have to pay your taxes. But then the question becomes, well, what's Caesar's, right? Because right now I think Caesar wants more than Caesar's. And I just tell people, it's very simple. It's a very simple principle. If Caesar wants more than God, it's immoral. And God only wants 10%. So anything more than that, you are not obligated in justice to pay. But here's the kicker. You can't lie on your taxes because ends don't justify the means. So people can prudently hide if they're making more than that. On the other hand, one time Bill Gates, I don't know how much, he made like several billion dollars in one year and paid 75,000 in taxes. That's immoral.
Sure.
So, and that's why when they say, oh, we're going to raise the taxes on the rich, no, you're not. You'll just raise the tax to make it look good and then you'll create the loopholes. I mean, it's all silly. It's all a game. That's why I'm kind of one of those, let's get a tax, flat tax rate. But then we also got to get the government out of certain things. Part of the reason the taxes are so high is because of the fact that what used to be taken care of by the church through corporal works of mercy are now being handled by the government.
Right.
So, okay. It commands the virtue of thriftiness against prodigality. So you just don't, you know, waste money. Why did you buy these beans? Because they were on sale. You can eat them? No. All right. That actually happened to me once. Somebody did that. I'm like, what? Okay. They were only 99 cents. I'm like, okay, that's fine. So, I guess, I guess that's, well, I don't know. I sat in the thing for like a year and a half, I guess. All right. Gambling and betting. If they deprive someone of the basic living needs for himself or others, or if it constitutes an addiction. Gambling, as long as it's done in moderation, and betting can be a legitimate form of recreation, but you just have to be careful that it doesn't take away from your obligations. Which, if people aren't careful, it can do very easily. Excessive, unnecessary waste of goods, resources, money, or funds. I read a study, I don't know how true it is. You know, sometimes you read these things and you're just like, when did they come up with that number? You know, and I think this is a bit excessive, but I think it does point to something. They said in this country, they said the amount of food wasted in our country is almost 40% of it. That's, I mean, so, yeah. Okay, Eighth Commandment. So it requires thriftiness, resourcefulness. The Eighth Commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. So this commands the virtue of truthfulness, which means that the person always has to be truthful in what they say and how they behave. There's a distinction they make between what's called simulation and lying. Lying is when you say something that's false in order to deceive somebody, whereas simulation is when you do something false in order to deceive somebody. And you see a certain amount of that. So you have to be truthful. It commands a virtue of community justice in relationship to a person's name. The person's name is their property. And so if you violate it, you are essentially stealing something over which they have a right. This is why things like gossiping and rumoring are actually a violation of commutative justice. It also commands retributive justice. If you have unduly soiled someone's name or blackened someone's name, you have an obligation to restore it. So next time you start thinking you're going to badmouth somebody, rethink that. And that's on two parts. One, if you say something that's false, you have to go back and correct it to the person who said it. The second is if you have said something that's true, which is detraction, but it takes away from the reputation unduly. So that you also have to say, look, okay, what I said was true, but look, it's not as bad as it is. And this, usually if you tell people, they have to do that, oh, I got to go back and tell people I didn't tell the truth. Yeah. So, I think I gave a homily on gossiping. I think there was 8 virtues it violated. I can't remember which they where I did that. Oh, yeah, I did that. It was in Tulsa. I don't think I recorded it, though. Okay. Then there is also rumoring. That's what we call it in English, but if we say the word, you know, murmuring in English, it usually means a guy just kind of murmuring. But murmuring actually in Latin, I like the word in Latin, it's susurratio. It's kind of got that little twist, you know, that little reiteration thing to it. But And it means that you speak against someone's reputation in order to separate other people's affections from them. You see this among parents happening from time to time. They'll badmouth their husband or their wife to their children in order to make the children like them more. You see that once in a while. It's called murmuring. Rash judgment. This forbids rash judgment. That is, judging that somebody is guilty of something without a sufficient reason. It does not forbid judging the objective moral content of a person's behavior. For example, two people are living together and they're unmarried. People will say, well, you can't judge them. Okay. It is true that I don't know the moral state of these people. That's true. I don't know if they're committing mortal sin, even if they're fornicating. I don't know that because I don't know what's going on in their mind. I mean, people are clueless today. I once said from the pulpit, I said, you know, there's something wrong with a culture when smoking and drinking is a mortal, or smoking is a mortal sin, but fornication is a virtue. You know, it's a time that everything's turned upside down. But the point is that, okay, so I don't know that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I don't recognize that these people are living in a situation that objectively offends God. Objectively, whether subjectively, I can't access that, but I can look at it. And this is important because, you know, if you have with your children, you have to make those kinds of judgments all the time about the company they keep and those kinds of things. You don't know about the sins. You don't know why little Johnny is being obnoxious, but you tell your son, I don't want you hanging around him. Because it doesn't really matter what the sinfulness of little Johnny is in relationship to what your son's going to learn about how to be sneaky. Okay. It also, refusing or delaying to restore the good name of one who is blackened is bad. Baseless accusations, groundless suspicions, rash judgments of others in our own mind, etc. It commands a virtue of commutative justice. What does this mean? Justice is rendering to someone their due. If you rashly judge somebody, you are going to excess in your authority and you're therefore violating justice in relationship to them because it's not due to them to be rashly judged. It also requires the virtue of discretion. Revealing secrets is sinful to the degree of the gravity of the secret that is revealed. It can be mortally sinful to reveal secrets. Publishing discreditable secrets about others, even if true, that's the one you want to send to the politicians. Okay. So this is the thing you have to keep in mind. Bear false witness means that, you know, you're lying. Because you're lying about your neighbor. But it really deals with justice. And this is primarily what's covered under this is justice. And discretion in the sense of modesty, which is discretion is a sub-virtue of modesty. The ninth commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. This commands justice in relationship to others and relationships to our thoughts and feelings, temperance. Once in a while you hear people say, well, I can look, but I can't touch. Sorry, pal. Doesn't work. There, in every moral act, there is the act, and then there's the object upon which the action bears. So, for example, I always give the example of throwing midgets off of a building. Okay, so you're standing up there and you're throwing these little midgets off of a 10-story building, right? Okay. Now, the question becomes, is that moral or not? Throwing midgets off of a building. Well, it depends on the status of the midget, right? If he has committed a capital crime and you are the executioner, then it's a just action, right? Because the object, that is the midget who's committed a capital crime, is this action of throwing him off is due to that action fits him because he's committed a capital crime, so you're executing the capital punishment, right? Okay. Or maybe he's a combatant. You know, some of those midgets are pretty handy. So you have to throw him off to get him, you know, to secure the premises, so to speak. Or maybe it's just murder, right? There's not a justifying condition for it, and so the action of throwing him off doesn't suit him as the object, right? What does that mean? It means that the kind of action you perform and the object that you're dealing with, the action has to fit it. Give me another example. You see somebody stealing an elderly woman's, or stealing, okay, I want to rephrase that. You're standing on the street corner, and all of a sudden you see this guy who's all tattooed out and earrings and everything, and got a bone in his nose. And you see him taking this purse from an elderly white woman, right? So you're just like, whoa, what's up with that? That's stealing. You don't know that. Because it could be his purse, right? Okay. So, that being said, if it's his purse, the act of taking suits the purse. If it's not his purse, the act of taking doesn't fit it, right? This object they call due matter. The action has to fall on due matter. It has to suit the particular object or matter of the thing that's being acted upon. Now, usually St. Thomas talks about that in the context of conjugal relations. You have to have due matter, right? She has to be your wife. It's only if you're married that it's due matter in relationship to the conjugal act. But that is also true in relationship to your thoughts and into what you view, like, for example, on the internet, like things like pornography. Pornography is you're viewing, you're seeking out satisfaction in something which doesn't fall upon due matter. She's not your wife. And if she is, you better get it off the internet. Okay, but the point is that it doesn't fall on the proper matter. She's not your wife. And you, therefore, you're not permitted to think those things. If she is your wife, you're permitted. St. Thomas says, he who has rights over the lesser has rights, or the rights of the greater has rights to the lesser. So a man can think about conjugal relations with his wife and not commit any sin. Of course, he has to be careful that temperance is still observed. But that's just part of it. Okay. So that's something to keep in mind, that in relationship to the ninth commandment, it commands justice. If you think about a woman or a man in that way, it's actually a sin against justice, because it's not due to them. They're not your wife, they're not your husband. But it also is a sin against temperance, because you're taking pleasure in it. So it commands justice and temperance. It commands modesty in relationship to custody of the senses. You have to keep custody of the eyes. You know, keep your mind off that, so keep your eyes off that stuff. And then it requires custody of the mind, which really is the virtue of truthfulness. The truth is, I should only be contemplating truth in relationship to those things that are suited to me as an individual. One time this one guy was trying to argue with me. He says, all knowledge is good. I said, yes, in se, that's what they say in Latin, in itself, but not with respect to a particular individual. He says, no, it's always good. I said, really? His wife was sitting next to him. Would it be good for you to have carnal knowledge of the woman next door to you? Well, that put a quick end to that discussion. The point being is that it requires truthfulness. It's false. Your person is committing a falsity by... and that's actually something that's true in every sin. In every sin, the virtue of truthfulness is violated. Because I talked a little bit about it last night. The conscience, the thing comes into the mind... The conscience makes an act of judgment. This is sinful. What happens is, St. Thomas says that with the whole moral tradition, and I think it's even in one of the documents of the church, recent documents of the church, that we cannot will something under the aspect of evil. It has to always be willed under the aspect of the good. It has to be seen good in some way for us to will it. And this is true even of people who commit really malicious things. They're still doing it under some aspect of the good, like I get power over this. So, that being said, every time you commit a sin, the will, it's presented to the will as this is a pleasurable thing or this is a good thing, but there's this evil part of it that's presented to the will, and the will has to make a choice. But St. Thomas, the guy's a genius, he says it can't will it in that state. What happens is the will has to turn around and move the intellect to ignore or to judge out, remove in its judgment the evil of it and focus only on the good. That's a lie. And it militates against the nature of the intellect. That's why one of the proper effects of sin is dullness of the intellect, because it basically does violence to the intellect by forcing us to look at something in a way that it's not designed to do. So every sin is a sin against the virtue of truthfulness. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, the only way you're going to be freed from sin is through truth. It's not helpful to people to leave them in ignorance unless it's absolutely necessary before you can begin to prepare them before you give them the information. 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. This virtue commands the virtue of liberality. Now, liberality is not the virtue of giving away other people's money. It is the virtue of giving away your own money. And one of the ways that you know most modern liberals are not truly liberal is the fact that they're quick to give everyone else's money, but they're hoarding their own. So, the virtue of liberality works against greed and the desire for to have material goods without limit, avarice. It also commands the virtue of simplicity. Simplicity is the virtue in which you have no more and no less than you need. When my grandparents were alive, every time I would walk into their house, it was an education. And it was entertainment too, but it was an education. They had literally, the only thing they had in their house that was not necessary, the only thing was a television. They didn't own, everything else they owned was necessary for ordered living. That was it. They didn't have anything more than that. And it's not because they didn't have the money. Because my grandfather sold the farm in Iowa at a time when it was a good time to sell. And then he moved out to Wyoming where we grew up. But he didn't spend all his money. He didn't need it, so he didn't spend it. He was also very generous with me, especially as I was going through the seminary. In fact, at one stage, he was actually paying for all of my personal expenses as I was going through the seminary a few years there. So he was very generous. The point is that it helps. The virtue of simplicity is the virtue which you have no more and no less than you need. In the fraternity of St. Peter, they have an exhortation that they recommend that a priest each year goes through every single thing he owns. If he hasn't used it in a year and he's not going to use it in a year, you get rid of it. It's liberating, I can tell you. The desire, it also moderates the desire to become rich at all costs. It also moderates businesses and professions or professionals who hope for unfavorable circumstances of others so that they can personally profit from it. I don't know if you saw this, but there was this one guy who works in Wall Street, and he says he loves it when the economy tanks. Because there's specific ways they are bilking people through that process. Then there's the virtue of charity, which is against envy. Envy is different from jealousy. People always get these kind of mixed up. Jealousy is when you have something, but you don't want someone else to have it. Which you often see with people who are really, really wealthy. I knew this one priest, he was a millionaire. And he said, "We don't want you to get rich." Hello? Is there an elephant in the room? I mean, okay. The point is that jealousy is when you have something you don't want someone else to do. Envy is when someone else has something, but you don't have it, and you want to get it to their loss of it. So, envy, like for instance, the demons have envy because they want us to lose the goods of our lives and the goods of our soul because they don't have it. So, commands a virtue of charity in that respect. To don't have envy of someone else's success, talents, temporal or spiritual goods. These are good things. The proper response to good is joy, not sorrow. If you have sorrow at someone else's good or something, there's something disordered in your own soul in relationship to that. Unless the particular good that they have attained is actually not to their spiritual betterment. So, for example, you know, it's kind of sad that some people are rich. Now, riches are not evil, despite what people want to say. It just means that people have to have detachment from it. But it's sad because of the fact that a lot of people have a lot of money, but they don't pay any attention to their spiritual life. Or they get involved in this weird, you know, New Age stuff because it lets them kind of keep their riches and do their things, what they keep doing, and try and sate that natural desire we have for spiritual goods. So that's the thing to always keep in mind. It's always necessary to keep the goods. The response should be, as you become holier, as charity begins to take more dominance in your life, when you see good things happen to people, you'll be happy whether you have them or not. And that's a sign of a certain sign of a spiritual advancement. Okay, so just to recount just a little bit. Temperance, fortitude, justice, and prudence. We've seen all of those. Faith, hope, and charity, we've seen all of those. We've seen wisdom. There's also what we haven't seen is knowledge and understanding. St. Thomas, I'll end with this. St. Thomas says that Christ preaches every virtue from the cross. Temperance, the sponge is put to his mouth, he turns away. Justice, he's rendering to God, is due by an act of sacrifice. Fortitude, well, that's pretty self-evident. Prudence, he's the means to us attaining our end. Faith, well, he didn't have the act of faith, but he preaches it because through faith in the cross we'll be saved. Hope, it's the means of our salvation. And charity, no greater love does a man have than to lay down his life for his friends. That's why they say that Christ is the fulfillment of the law. He is the fulfillment of the Ten Commandments, the law itself, the one who promulgates it. He's the one hanging on the cross. And he's the one that preaches all of the virtues.